Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. With that memorable declaration, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce surrendered in 1877 to General Nelson Miles. His words signaling a noble submission, a white flag, knowing when you're lost and being willing to lay down your weapons in defeat. Now wars are borderless, conflicts are ideological, and battles are fought door-to-door in cities and in gruesome videos posted online. Today, declarations of surrender are increasingly rare, almost antiquated. And the world is caught up in what seems like a never-ending series of wars. So what happened? Carlin Romano is critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where we found his article, Whatever Happened to Surrender, which contains a lot of the lessons he learned from the anthology How Fighting Ends. It's a history of surrender, edited by Holger Offlerbach and Hugh Strachan. Carlin Romano joins us now from Beijing, where he is currently teaching. And Carlin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for liking the article.
Well, it was really interesting being reminded that formal surrender used to be the way to end conflict, which we heard a lot about this year at the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, reminded of General Robert E. Lee's surrender to Ulysses S. Grant. So what happened there that we don't see anymore?
Well, one thing I learned from this book that I relied on a lot in writing the piece, and I really do recommend it to people because they really take us back all the way to prehistoric times. And way back then, surrender was kind of a non-starter. Losers just got killed. So it's really, it seems, in the Middle Ages and into the modern era where surrender becomes a possibility. It's not totally dishonorable. As for today, I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the article was that we don't have clear-cut winners and losers in the way that we used to.
Why is that? Is it the nature of warfare? Are today's combatants ideologically unwilling to admit defeat, or there's just no end in sight?
Well, the book is fascinating on that. One thing that surprised me is that today a lot of military outfits, and particularly the outfits run by states rather than by terrorist groups, don't really go all out for victory. And one of their aims is actually casualty avoidance. And I think, you know, when we see current U.S. policy, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, we understand that we're often trying to avoid casualties, right, with our use of drones and so on. So partly it's that people don't go all out to win anymore. And of course, we have the constraints of the Geneva Convention and laws of war, which didn't really govern things in prehistoric times. So the kinds of things, for instance, that we did, the Allies in World War II, the firebombing of Dresden, killing lots and lots of noncombatants, is really considered unacceptable today for civilized countries. That also makes it hard for clear-cut victors to emerge.
Well, we know Neanderthals didn't, you know, shake hands and drink sherry and agree to stop fighting. What do we know about the origins of surrender rather than just killing the vanquished?
Yeah, well, it seems like mankind had to go pretty far before it really got to the point of accepting surrender. There are a lot of examples in the book, and I mentioned some in my article about how, you know, in ancient Greece, for instance, the Spartans told their soldiers to return, quote, with your shield or on your shield, but not without your shield. You know, you're really supposed to fight, you know, to the death. One thing that seemed to happen in the Middle Ages is that victors recognized that losers and prisoners had value, particularly in regard to knights. So knights often had very wealthy friends and families that would ransom them. And that meant that victors began to think, gee, even if I don't want to feed these prisoners, even if I don't want to take them with us, there's a way to deal with them rather than killing them. You know, we can start negotiating, we can start talking. And as soon as victors and losers started to talk, the possibility of what a lot of the scholars called honorable surrender began to emerge.
How about the whole notion of the white flag? When did that symbolism become used?
Well, it's interesting. White flags actually go back to the Romans. But one of the things I learned, contrary to what I thought I knew, is that a white flag in international law actually doesn't constitute surrender. What it means in international law is we like to talk about surrender. And another interesting aspect of surrender throughout the centuries is that there's something the scholars call failed surrender or tricky surrender, where one party pretends to surrender to draw out the other party and then attacks them.
How about this idea of these genteel rules in honor of engagement? You know, the idea that two generals would just shake hands and say, okay, we're not fighting anymore. How did that era and that way of ending conflicts arise?
Well, it does seem, I mean, an observation that pops up at different places, you know, in the book and in the history of scholarship about surrender is that surrender is a lot more possible between opponents who share a culture. And if they share a culture, they may share mutual respect. So you referred to the famous, you know, meeting between Robert E. Lee and Ulysses Grant at Appomattox. And that was an example of that, where General Grant decided that the soldiers would be allowed to leave with their full honors, their horses and their weapons, because he respected Robert E. Lee. And despite all the bloodshed and the mayhem, there was a respect between the rival armies. One difficulty that I think we have today when we're fighting, say, Boko Haram or Islamic State, is that, as we've seen, there's virtually no agreement on values. There's a belief you can behead people, whether they're innocent or guilty or for the slightest deviation from Islamic belief. So when the two sides really have an enormous cultural gap, it's hard to reach that gentlemanly stage.
Carlin Romano is with us, and he wrote Whatever Happened to Surrender for the Chronicle of Higher Education. In it, he explores the concept of surrender, which is increasingly rare in today's global-scale warfare. Carlin, contemporary culture abhors this notion of being a loser. So are conflicted parties or fighting bodies today desperate to avoid that kind of stigma of being called the loser?
I do think that is something that has kind of continued throughout history. It's particularly strong early on. I mean, that's what the Spartans were talking about. One of the scholars in this book who wrote about the Roman period wrote that any Roman who did surrender disgraced himself, you know, and his family. So the further back you go in history, it seems the idea that surrender is a disgrace is very powerful. Then a phrase comes up in the scholarship, which I think captures what we're talking about here, sensible surrender. And it's the idea that, you know, when all is lost, when there's nothing you can do against your opponent anymore, it just doesn't make any sense, you know, to keep fighting or force yourself to be killed. And the great writer about war, many people have heard of him, even if they haven't read him, named Clausewitz, German scholar, wrote in a very famous line that all of these people who study surrender quote, that, quote, there is a point beyond which persistence becomes desperate folly and can therefore never be condoned. So he was kind of saying it's just illogical at a certain point to keep fighting. And when everybody began to recognize that, surrender became possible.
How about for a group that is effectively losing a war, losing a battle? What other options are there if not surrender?
Well, one of the traditional options was just to run. I mean, really to like throw your arms down and run as fast as you could and try to get away from the enemy. And that was one way of basically exiting the battlefield. There's something that the scholars called forced surrender, and a particularly strong illustration is the number of times that a horse would fall on a soldier and basically pin the soldier. So there was nothing that could be done. But, you know, basically running, disappearing, fleeing was the standard way to avoid surrender, but avoid also being killed.
Looking back through history, our epic poems, you know, our novels, our songs, and certainly movies, historically have glorified this notion of choosing death over surrender. Why do you think our culture often looks at that kind of sacrifice as heroic, rather than the kind of heroism of saying, let's just stop fighting?
Yeah, well, this was a funny thing I learned from the book also, which is that some of the fighters that you would most expect to live up to that standard, which were the knights in medieval times, were actually the ones most likely to run or to surrender quickly or to quickly send a message to the other side that said, you know, I have very rich friends and a very rich family. Don't kill me. I can get you some money, you know, protect me. And often they were treated extremely well. They might even be invited into the tent and have a nice meal while we contact your cousin. You know, it's a strange thing. But I'd say generally that as individualism grew, and as fighters became more upper class than lower class, which they seemed to do in the Crusades and elsewhere, the value of an individual life became very important. Knights didn't want to die for no good reason. When in earlier times, you're basically having the lowest levels of society fight, and their lives are not valued by anyone, and sometimes even not by themselves, you had a greater likelihood that people would kind of go down with the ship and, you know, fight to the last drop of blood.
How about now, in this age of the suicide bomber, of Boko Haram, of ISIS, you know, these wars globally publicized online, is the likelihood of surrender becoming even slimmer?
Well, you know, that really does seem to be the judgment of a lot of people who study this, that, you know, one of the co-editors remarks that, quote, the readiness to surrender has rarely been weaker, unquote, you know, in our world today. I think I'd go back to that original idea that prospective winners aren't trying hard enough to win. One thing you see over and over in the history of warfare is that the eventual loser often doesn't give up until the loser's property, family, army has been totally destroyed. There has to be a tremendous amount of pain applied. And the laws of war have in many ways lessened that amount of pain. So I'm not arguing here that we should go back to a pre-Geneva era, but realistic assessment of why surrender has disappeared does seem to be connected to, in a sense, various sides fighting with one hand behind their back. And so battles never get resolved.
Well, Carlin Romano, a lot to think about. Thank you for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carlin Romano teaches at Beijing Foreign Studies University. He's also a critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of the book America, the Philosophical. And you'll find a link to read his article, Whatever Happened to Surrender, where there's more on the book, How Fighting Ends, A History of Surrender. All of it at wordofmouthradio.org.